Welcome to the podcast. As always, this is your host, Kyle Willard. I'm going to tell you, this is a topic. It's a hard one. You know, it's one of those, especially when you look at software engineering and kind of the world around it, the social influences, the political influences. These are all aspects that, you know, a lot of us really don't want to delve into. You know, it's kind of a gray area, and it's one that most of us want to keep a gray area. So I'm going to be honest, I've re-recorded this podcast probably half a dozen times at this point. And the reason for that is that I don't want to delve into politics. That's not what this is about. That's not the long-term goal of this podcast. If I wanted to delve into politics, there are much different topics I would pursue. This is about software engineering. It's going to stay about software engineering. But today, if you couldn't guess, we're going to touch on some of the intersections between software engineering, politics, and the social world at large. We're going to talk about social media. We're going to talk about Parler and the situation with it. And we're going to try and skate around the political side of things as much as possible. There's a lot of aspects to it. And there's a lot of things to understand. So we're going to kind of go over the history of social media. We're going to talk about some of the big changes. And I want to make it clear up front, I'm not going to be, you know, talking one way or the other into different groups' ideologies, you know, their mindsets, you know, whether I agree with them or not. None of that matters. What matters is how we, as software engineers, actually, you know, take the world around us and use it to inspire and influence what we build. And it's also a good reminder that we affect the town square because, you know, as a software engineer at this point, 90% of our work is going to be on, you know, web-based platforms. And so because of that, it's our job to make the right decisions and, you know, do right by the stakeholders, do right by, you know, the people paying the bills, you know, their interests and making sure that we align with them. So let's start here. Let's start with social media and where it came from, you know, and this is going to come, there are a number of sources as always. And this one is going to come from Digital Trends. I will drop the show notes. I'm a little backed up on the YouTube side of things. I will get that up this week. It's been kind of a crazy one, to be quite honest. So social media came from, you know, the bulletin board system or BBS. You know, originally these forums, you know, they were built for niche groups. Predominantly, they tended to be technologically based, and they evolved into social media platforms over time. You know, and where we saw that was in 97, we saw Six Degrees come out. Now, I don't know if you're like me, but I have no idea what the hell this platform is. I don't remember it. I was around for it. I don't remember it. I mean, I was inundated with tech at that point. 97, I would have been delving pretty hard into, you know, the IT side of things. I did a lot of gaming back then. So in 01, it expanded, and all of a sudden we had Friendster. These were rudimentary compared to what we have right now, right? And the big takeaway that we took away from these platforms really was we really started to see email address registration and basic online networking. You know, we had weblogs or blogs were another form. And the source on this, guys, just so you know, is Maryville.edu. But yeah, so we had blogs. You know, LiveJournal started in 99, and, you know, Blogger launched roughly the same time, and then, you know, it ended up getting purchased by Google in 03. In 2002, and this is honestly, and there's not a lot of credit for it, but this is honestly one of the larger platforms still around, and that's LinkedIn, started in 2002. You know, by 2020, LinkedIn had grown to over 675 million people. 675 million people. Keep that in mind. That's, you know, that far surpasses the U.S. population, like six times the amount, roughly. But yeah, so, you know, it was the social media site of choice for job seekers as well as HR managers, and still is today. In fact, they've added a job search. They've added a premium package to it. It's all sorts of awesome. You know, it does a lot, especially, you know, for those of us looking for work and for those of us wanting to build a network of people doing similar work. It really fits the bill, and it will continue to fit the bill. You know, I don't see LinkedIn leaving anytime soon because it is so well grounded. I think long term, you know, there are going to be some evolutions that have to happen, or you will start to see a decline as other services kind of come into the market. But I think LinkedIn is here to stay. You know, they're doing a great job over there. Let's take a look. So 2003, MySpace launched. Oh, dear Lord. This was honestly, for me, probably the first major social media platform that I ever got involved with. I actually, you know, during my time in LA, I actually met a couple of the executives. One of them actually backed in to the work truck that we were using, working in an event in LA. that was weird. But yeah, I met a couple of them, usually in bad situations, ironically enough. But yeah, so 2006, it was the most visited website on the planet. But here's the deal. I want to make this really clear. You know, MySpace was amazing, but all of a sudden in 2008, it was destroyed. And it was destroyed by, you know, the social media platform that we all know and love, Facebook. And kind of the reason that that happened is that Facebook invested a lot in building connections, whereas MySpace was more of a, hey, you know, show yourself off. And, you know, because of that, it really got decimated. It still technically exists. In 2011, it was, you know, purchased by Justin Timberlake. But it was only purchased for a measly $35 million. Realistically, you know, if it had been done right, it should have been even then worth a couple billion dollars. But it wasn't. 2008, it was eclipsed by Facebook. You know, but it has become a social media afterthought. Google's attempt to elbow its way into the social media landscape, Google Plus, launched in 2012. I hope I don't have to explain the data breach that kind of killed that one. That was a bad one. But yeah, so that was the evolution, right? We had this platform called Six Degrees that none of us remember. 2001, we had Friendster, which I think a lot of us had Friendster accounts, but again, it wasn't really a thing. And I'm gonna take a break here and deviate from show notes because I really want to kind of poke at this too, because while we're looking at social media, the one thing we're not looking at is that, you know, chat rooms were pervasive. You know, they were all throughout the landscape. Basically, if you ran a website, you had a chat room or a chat box of some sort. And the reality is that, you know, this was also the period of time, you know, this evolution from 97 till probably 2008 was really where the internet started to get dangerous. You really started to see trolling, cyberbullying, etc. You know, I want to say that a I want to say that during the same, during the same period, you had 4chan launch in October of 2003, and it again was just a bulletin board style site. But the internet took a dark turn. The internet in its creation, you know, when it opened to the public, it really was about, you know, sharing information. There was a mindset of if you build something, you share it. And that, you know, that's still adopted, but at a different level than it used to be. Sure, we have GitHub and Gitbucket and, you know, Code Sandbox and what have you. But at the end of the day, you know, there's a lot of aspects that have changed. You know, the securing of data, you know, the addressing data leaks and ensuring that, you know, people's information is taken care of and, you know, passwords are hashed, what have you. These really became a thing because the internet started to get dark, you know. And it was across all the sectors. You know, you had people gaming e-commerce sites for, you know, cheap or free stuff. You had, you know, data breaches from dating websites. I think that a good one to point out is Ashley Madison. A ton of people that were on Ashley Madison got breached and got nailed. You know, and even social media, Google Plus, you know, in I want to say it was 2013, 2014, basically right after it started, they got nailed to the wall with a horrible data breach. So, I mean, it's something to pay attention to that the internet got a lot darker during that period. But I think we've kind of held that off. And instead of the internet just being this horrible, nasty thing, we've started to, as you know, a global society, right? Because the internet really truly is global. As a global society, we've started to, you know, say, hey, these are some standards that we want to have in place, and we're starting to put them in. You know, what changed in the world around us? You know, in one word, everything. Everything has changed since the 1990s. You know, with the evolution of mobile devices, with the evolution of the internet just being a research tool, you know, something to, you know, kind of use to glean information and then just to build off of. You know, it communications, networking, even business has completely evolved to adopt the internet. And social media really, at least in my opinion, has been at the forefront of that, which is why we're talking about it, right? You know, it's one of those where, you know, when I was a kid, I would go out and I'd you know, play some video games for, you know, 4 or 6 hours, maybe 8. And then I'd go out in the yard with friends and we'd, you know, act that out. Now, good luck trying to get the kids off of tablets or, you know, Nintendo Switches or what have you. You know, now they're neck deep in Minecraft, Roblox, and Fortnite. It's a different generation. And the current generation, you know, my generation's kids, you know, that are somewhere between basically 6 and 12, they are really substantially more technologically advanced. And if you actually look generationally, my parents and my parents' parents, like it goes from never touching a computer until they were in their late 30s at the earliest to, you know, starting to learn how to use them. And then my parents had them for, you know, high school, college, but it was, you know, the original Apple devices, or it was, you know, these old school bricked out IBMs. But I mean, at the end of the day, right, you know, these basically didn't exist in the same way. And now I have in my iPhone, I have the same level of computing power as I did in, you know, probably middle school, right? You know, here's a device that if I really wanted to play the game, I could sit there and I could set it up and I could play Doom or I could play GoldenEye or, you know, I could basically play whatever I want from back in the day. And that's the point, right? You know, our computers are vastly different, and the internet is evolving because it's been so culturally and societally adopted across the board on a global scale. So let's talk about what changed for adults, right? You know, obviously when the internet event was, you know, really pushed to the public, I was a little kid, right? I remember dial-up. I remember, you know, playing with it. We had a Hewlett Packard. HP used to be Hewlett Packard. You know, it was a pile of crap. Let's be real. It was overpriced. It's like $600-$700. It was a hunk of junk. You know, and it was a nightmare. But yeah, so for adults, you know, even for me in, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, when I was kind of going from, you know, doing school to applying for jobs, you know, for some of the first jobs I had, it was expected that you walked down the street and you picked up physical paper applications. You went home, you filled them all out, you walked down the street again, you handed them all in, and then you would physically visit each one of those businesses to follow up to get a job. Now, it's culturally accepted that you're going to fill out an online application. They may have some sort of an aptitude test or a, you know, screening test as far as your psyche. It's kind of weird, right? And then, you know, you were expected to either make a phone call or just hold off until they get a hold of you. And you can actually see the progress that your application has by an online medium. You know, think about your taxes. Back in the day, it was all paper forms. You know, think about buying a house. Think about buying a car. I mean, hell, you've got Carvana, where quite literally you can do a trade-in and buy a car and basically never talk to anybody. They come, they pick the car up, they bring your car, you sign some paperwork remotely. All of a sudden, you have a car, you don't have to worry about it. You switch your insurance, you're off to the races, right? It's all just done. So, you know, so it really, the internet has evolved in such a way to really be a useful tool in vastly different ways than we ever expected, right? I don't know about you, but I could have expected it. You know, being, you know, I remember back on AOL, it was just kind of little portal. Everything was, you know, white background, black text, and blue links. Oh, that's what Amazon looked like when it first started. Now it's this robust application that has so many moving pieces that they have to have tens of thousands of engineers just to maintain it. So, you know, it kind of sounds like I'm blaming social media for the changes, right? I'm blaming, you know, social media for the change, you know, in adopting technology on such a grand scale. And to a degree, I am, right? But for real, I mean, we've kind of seen a gradual and natural evolution. You know, it's a lot more accessible. We can pull up the internet in our pocket. We have the ability to stream movies on our phones. You know, hell, if you really want to push your luck, you can stream movies on your car. And that's the point, right? Humans as species, we've always tried to find ways to make our jobs easier. You know, building tools, evolving those tools, you know, that's kind of been our shtick. And as soon as the internet really started to become more of a town square, it really has become a town square in a lot of ways, because you've got your market, right? You've got Amazon, you've got Walmart, you've got Best Buy, you have all of these companies that are selling things online. You have your newspapers. Instead of having the, you know, the guy standing at the corner screaming, "Hey, get your daily paper," or standing in a newsstand, now, you know, your news is aggregated to hundreds of different sites. You know, it really has become the town square. You know, you can, we're almost to the point where we can have a political debate and have questions piped in digitally and have those questions answered real time, which is, in my opinion, that should be the next evolution. I think that being made to answer questions that aren't scripted, that are completely random, that come from the general public, I think that would be an amazing thing. I think that we're going to see a lot of screening. I think there's specific questions that won't ever see the light of day. You know, I wish I wish that we could go to that fundamentally pure, you know, mentality of, you know, if a question pops up, let's do it. You know, set a certain amount of questions, you answer the questions, your opponent answers the questions, you squabble between the two of you, and all of a sudden now we have vastly more information because you don't know the answers going into it. You don't know the questions going into it. That's a big thing. And I think that's going to be really, really cool coming forward. And I think it's honestly going to be one of those things that starts to bridge the divide, because people will be able to see in a more honest way, you know, what the candidates they're voting for are about. So that's really cool. And the nice thing is that it means more jobs for us software engineers, right? It means that we're building the platform, the tool for this kind of stuff to happen. You know, there's already examples of it. I mean, technically, if you go to twitch.tv and you sit there and you watch a streamer, it's the same kind of concept, right? You know, if you're asking just the question side of things, you know, you've got mechanisms like Slido where you can just have a mountain of questions. So yeah, I'm not blaming it. I think we're just seeing a natural evolution. You know, I do want to take a step back and say, hey, you know, this is a topic that I've talked about. This was almost the topic for the original episode, and then it was almost the topic for the second episode, and now it's, you know, the topic for the third. And the reason being is that I think it is such a powerful thing to examine, you know, understanding that we as software engineers have almost more of a moral imperative to pay attention to what we're doing and how we're taking care of the people that we're serving, right? And we are serving people. I mean, let's not get it twisted. You know, we're serving our stakeholders, but by serving our stakeholders, we're also serving their clients and their customers. You know, whether it is a, you know, basic website with just HTML, CSS, images, links, what have you, all the way to, you know, creating the next Facebook or YouTube or Twitter. You know, it's our job to make sure that we're doing the best. So I did on YouTube drop kind of an introduction to why JavaScript Lifestyles was created. And I definitely encourage you to take a look. You know, obviously the views are nice. Obviously expanding, you know, the reception of the podcast would be great. But at the end of the day, like that, this really is a medium that I can kind of come on and I can, you know, do my part to try and help up and coming developers and, you know, really just kind of have an honest conversation about things. So let's talk about social media and politics. Since 2016, it's been a huge, huge thing. It truly has. We've heard about Russian bots and, you know, affecting the U.S. We've heard about fake news. We've seen politicians getting censored. We've seen politicians saying stupid things. These are growing pains. This is honestly part of what, to be honest, I kind of expected was going to come. This is new uncharted territory that honestly we're moving. Traditionally, those who controlled the newspaper and the media tended to be able to get their point across better than the people that didn't. And that's on a global scale. I'm not just saying the United States, but that's on a global scale. The people who own the news and the news that people are actually consuming are the ones that are in charge of the election. And it's kind of a higher barrier of entry to get over that hump and get elected. I think that's a fair statement. And I think with social media, because we the people, you know, again, let's reference U.S. politics only, we the people get to say whatever the hell we want, which means we can talk about, you know, the Alex Jones conspiracy theories of turning the frogs gay. Okay, well, that's special. Let's move away from that, because let's be real, that's not something I'm really interested in. You know, we can talk about QAnon, we can talk about, you know, and Antifa using Twitter. These are growing pains. These platforms are being used for what they were designed for. The problem is that, you know, just like laws, companies don't have policies fully on the books for every single circumstance. It takes time to evolve those. And I think that's kind of the misnomer with the Senate specifically dragging in, you know, the heads of social media companies and basically grilling them and just trying to do their best to crucify them. It's like, guys, you didn't even know what the hell this was 5 years ago. Stop talking. This wasn't an issue 5 years ago. Stop talking. And a good example of that was, you know, the peer-to-peer torrenting or just distribution of copyrighted goods. You know, it used to be that there were websites that literally you could watch any movie on, any TV show. You could watch it. Literally anything. Why? Because somebody had an interest in it. They would, you know, figure out a way to steal it off the TV. They record it. They kick it online, and then they distribute it. And they would use P2P clients, or they would use different, you know, specific websites to do that. And guess what? Then we put into place on a global scale, basically. I think it was basically everybody said, yeah, we're done with this crap, so let's knock these sites down. All of a sudden, it was whack-a-mole to see how fast all of these governments could just beat the crap out of these websites and rip them down. And as soon as one dropped, another would come up. And then all of a sudden, you know, some of these individuals that were in charge of these websites started being put in jail and getting exorbitant fines and the whole nine. And all of a sudden, now it's just straight up torrents. You don't see that many websites that are doing that. And if they are, they're being based in international waters on some oil rig or something. Like they're not playing games anymore. They're finding the last loopholes that exist. And to be honest, they're covering their tail as best they can. But the point is that the internet evolves. As soon as there's one crisis, we find out how to combat that crisis. We put policies into place as a society. We put policies into place as countries. And, you know, the same goes for businesses. Until they can expect it, until they know to expect it, they can't do anything about it. You know, so you can argue, you know, that Twitter having, you know, some known terrorists still on there. You can argue that Twitter allowing, you know, Antifa to still be on Twitter. Sure. Are those great things? Probably not. Are those things that Twitter is probably looking at? Sure. Is there a difference between what they're doing and, you know, what Donald Trump did? Yeah, potentially. Potentially. Again, I'm not going to get into the hard minutia of politics on that, but I'm going to say that these are private companies. At the end of the day, just like any private company, they have the right to refuse service to anybody for any reason. Now, there is an exception to that. They do have terms of use and terms and, you know, TOCs. They have legalese built into their sites that say, if you violate my terms and conditions, I'm going to kick you loose. And if they just, you know, arbitrarily kick you off for no reason, and it's going to negatively impact you as a person or your business, there are legal forums that you can pursue that in. And I think that that's the correct route to go. If a platform feels like they need to kick somebody off for some reason, they're going to do it. But they also are fully aware that there are going to be circumstances in which they have legal actions pending towards them immediately. That's why they have mountains of lawyers protecting them, right? So let's move on. Let's talk about the good, right? Let's talk about the good. The good is that, and this is kind of a double-edged sword. The good is that news flies all over the world in seconds. Especially news from the U.S. I think that there are countries like China and the Middle East and North Korea and others that the news travels much slower. I think we eventually get the vast majority of it. But because of the different mechanisms inside of those countries, we don't get all the news very quickly. In the U.S., the U.K., you know, most of Europe, honestly, most of the world, right? As soon as something happens, we hear about it on a global scale instantly. And that's good and bad, right? And the good is that we're kept in the loop it's a lot harder to hide things from the general public than it used to be, which means that if our politicians, our leaders do something stupid, we're going to know about it, and we can take, as people, we can take action and deal with it, right? You know, I think that long term, this will be, you know, the downfall of a lot of politicians, because stupid crap that they do online and stupid crap that they do in real life, they're going to get caught, and the level of corruption is going to drop, you know, not a lot, but some. But here's the bad side. And this happens just as often as us getting the news from across the planet. The story is spun. The story is spun, and we get one viewpoint, or the viewpoint that people want us to get. And we have to dig deeper. That's the double-edged sword. Sometimes false information and spin is what gets eaten up by the crowd. And the crowd, as a general, you know, it's very hard to change the perspective of the majority of people once the story has already been established. And that's being used on a very, very large scale. And I mean, the reality is that this is what people's jobs are. There are people that are literally hired to deal with that. But here's kind of the good, right? Last year, BLM was all throughout the country, you know, preaching, doing their thing. And we saw, because of specifically BLM, we saw a huge increase of the usage of social media platforms and video platforms. You know, there was an entire website called Boke.net that was dedicated to live streams from protests. This is huge. This is massive. You know, I don't care if you agree or disagree with BLM or what have you. It doesn't matter. The ability by the people to march and get your point across, this is literally what the First Amendment was made for. This is our town square. We can project our message, our views, you know, and explain, you know, the harm that we've come to as a group throughout the internet. That means that we have the same kind of reach, realistically, and this isn't a joke, but we have the same kind of reach that Martin Luther King did marching through the Capitol. That's huge. That is massive. And that's a positive. We need to be able, especially in the United States as a country, to stand up and say, hey, we feel that this is wrong. These are my views. And be able to explain that. Now, activism and politics really aren't the only things there. You know, a really big one is marketing and social media. I think that this is the largest one, honestly. I think that this is the one that it will continue to power the internet. As long as these companies have ways to make money, they're going to continue being in business. And, you know, marketing is any number of things. It's the stupid videos before you can get into TikTok. It's the ads that you pay to remove off of YouTube because, dear God, who wants to watch them? It's the ads that you see on Hulu if you don't want to pay the premium price. You know, it's the ads you see on Twitch, same deal. And that's the model, right? Is that unless you pay money, you got to watch these ads. Dirty little secret, they're making more from the ads than they are, you know, you paying the premium, honestly. It's just an annoyance that you can get rid of. But that's the thing. That's what's next, is we're going to continue to evolve marketing. And from the usage of the internet, from, you know, the protests last year, you know, and the ones that are, I'm sure, coming in the future, because that's the way that our society is, we're going to see evolutions in marketing that stem from the methodologies that are used by the general public. You know, marketing tends to be behind the times versus the people. We, the people, as a collective, are a little bit more creative than we get a lot of credit for. We're going to see more short form video. We're going to see, you know, social commerce, where a lot of our e-commerce purchases are either in the social media sites or they're derived from social media sites. We're going to see, you know, further implementation of augmented reality. You know, if you buy a, if you go onto Amazon and you look and you want to buy some of the higher end Alexa devices, like the Show, there's actually an option if you're on your phone where you can use AR to see what it's going to look like in your room. It's kind of cool. You know, we're going to see more personalized marketing, and this is a really big hot button for a lot of people. And this is why people use VPNs. This is why people opt out of, you know, cookies, things such as that. Personalized marketing. Marketing that is specifically geared towards getting you to buy something. This is what's next. You know, the reality is that anything that you project into the internet, whether it's, you know, the sites you visit, what you post, what you look at, you know, what pictures you're taking, all of these have pieces of data which are collated, and you're basically turned into a profile, and you're going to see things that interest you. You know, if you're one of those people that you love to go out and you love to hike and kayak, you're going to see camping stuff. You're going to see kayaking, and you're going to see hiking stuff. If you're somebody who's obsessed with video games, you're going to see, you know, the latest games. You're going to see, you know, the best hardware to use for it. You know, and that's the thing, is that as time progresses, this will get smarter and smarter. And it scares a lot of people because it's a lot of information. But the reality is, we've been giving this information to people for basically ever. You know, let's talk about content for good. We mentioned BLM, you know, climate change, feminism, COVID-19, all of these, you know, all of these have been things that have, you know, led to the use of the internet. And I don't think that we can say any of them are not positive. I think the use of the town square to get message, you know, political ideologies and messages across, I think that's great. I think that if you feel like you're beaten down, you need to say something. And the best forum, if you feel like doing it, is the internet. Do it. I think the other piece of it, if you dive into YouTube a bit, you can find First Amendment and Fourth Amendment audits on police officers. You know, people are starting to hold authority figures to account for their actions. And that's not a negative thing. Holding people to account for their actions is a positive change. And that, I think, honestly, I really do think that, you know, when it comes to BLM, climate change, feminism, you know, if you're discriminating against somebody based on their gender or their race or their religion, like, you're a garbage human to begin with. Like, let's just get that out. It's 2021. Let's get that out of the sphere. You know, but if you have a message, you now have a platform that you can feel free to project that message onto. COVID-19, testing, news, like, this was rampant. And again, this was one of those double-edged swords, right? Because you had a lot of information saying, you know, how bad the vaccines were. You were saying that you had information back and forth. It was really, really confusing. Again, this is one of those situations that's growing pains. First of all, this was an unprecedented, you know, pandemic for our generations. You know, really, 1912 was the last major one. So this was unprecedented for the people that were running it and the people that were living it. So that was different. But we also had all these new tools that we're trying to implement. And I guarantee you, if this happened again in 5 years, it would be handled better. Because of the experience that we're taught today. I think that is, you know, we learn from our mistakes. And I think that there were mistakes, and I think that we learned from the majority of them. You know, I do want to hit on Parler, because Parler really was the jump off point here. And the reason that Parler was so frustrating for me is because I saw a group of people that were screaming as AWS and other hosts and, you know, the app stores were removing it. And there was one thing that caught me at the very beginning that really twisted me sideways. And that is, the same people that were denying Parler access to their services, AWS, Microsoft Azure, Google, are the same people that offer what Amazon gave them 2 weeks to implement, which is content moderation. There are tools that relatively are inexpensive that you can build in from these services and use, basically plug and play, that were ignored because of Parler's own stuff. Parler screwed up. They chose not to have content moderation. They got ripped off of every platform they were on because of it. Did they bounce back? Sure. Are they still doing some of the same stuff? Yes. Is that going to be a long-term issue? Yes. And I think that it's right to say that we need to have some sort of content moderation, especially when it comes to anyone under the age of 18. I think that we need to have content moderation when it comes to ensuring that we're not seeing cyberbullying, we're not seeing things like child porn or revenge porn. You know, we're not seeing people do call to actions to incite violence, you know, or crime. These are huge, huge things that are societal norms. These are things that we expect as a society. And I understand that the First Amendment exists. First Amendment is important. It really, really is. But by the same token, there's a level. And I think that maybe what we need to do is private companies, you know, need to remember that that level needs to be met. There are societal norms that we need to contend with. Now, I edited out part of this, and I want to be clear. I'm going to finish this in a very specific way. I think that, you know, on this topic, as software engineers, we need to be mindful. You know, I have a quote from Mahatma Gandhi. We but mirror the world. All the tendencies present in the outer world are to be found in the world of our body. If we could change ourselves, the tendencies in the world would also change. As a man changes his own nature, so does the attitude of the world change towards him. This is the divine mystery supreme. A wonderful thing it is, and the source of our happiness. We need not wait to see what others do. This quote is certainly inspiring. You know, it is certainly what I want to inspire. I want to be part of the change. I want to inspire others to strive to be the change that you want to see, which is what the quote was, you know, attributed to after the fact because it was wordy. But as you create applications, as you build new projects, be mindful of the impact on the world around you. If you distill the Parler situation down to a single issue, they miss the mindfulness that was required to ensure positive cultural acceptance. It's part of the job. Because of the evolution of the internet, software engineers are quickly becoming the arbiters of cultural change, because we are the ones building the applications that become the digital town square. That's the end of it, right? Next week, we will delve back into skills to know. We will keep pushing on that. The next one, we're going to be talking about JavaScript frameworks. You know, we're going to talk about React, Angular, Vue, stuff like that. We're going to talk about some libraries that are really, really useful. And we're going to go back to software. This was our one stop as far as politics. I think after that, I think I'm going to spend some time, and we're going to talk about boot camps for a little bit, specifically Lambda School and, you know, kind of pitfalls that boot camps fall into. And I think it's stuff that's information that we as students need to know, as people that want to learn. I think that it's things that employers need to know on their end. And I think as a general, I think that there's positive change there. So the next 2 weeks, that's what you're looking at. You're looking at frameworks, and then you're looking at a conversation about learning some more. We're going to talk about boot camps. Thank you for listening to the podcast. I hope to see you next week. This is Kyle Willard. I'm out.